Blog Talk Radio.
Sign him up. Give that boy a contract. Hello, everyone, and welcome to an indulgence, a place where we can indulge the senses just temporarily. Let me do some of the lifting for you today. Just sit back and relax. You know, deep breath and all that type of thing. Wrap your hand around your favorite beverage, depending where you are in the world. It might be morning, it might be evening or night. Adjust yourself accordingly, gentlemen. It's past the Ides of March, and I presume here that you're all thriving. Down in the southern hemispheres, you'd be looking at the onset of fall and the promises of renewal that come after that. Here we're looking at the greening of the days. The snows where I am are melting quickly, and we are drawn in spite of ourselves out of that fixation on tones of gray that wrap around us where I am this time of year to promises. It's anticipation. Tomorrow it's better. I do bow my head and recognize the pandemic and what it's done to the earth, to the people, to us. We have no choice but to prevail. And now, what else can you do but laugh? 40,000 variants. Well, I'm kind of thinking, I remember listening to virologists in the past who were always aware of the interesting potential of mutation and whether that could be harnessed for our benefit. But it's not anything, that's not a new discovery. It's just it reinforces that sense that everything is temporary. Our good health, our youth, our struggle with whatever demons are going on with that advantage, our aspirations, they are temporary and they constantly evolve. We satisfy ourselves, and in between real life is, you know, we have those peaks of happiness and those lows of contemplation and doubt, but in between is what we call real life. And here it is, masonry, to help us with that in between. if we're fortunate and resourceful, we'll have scratched our head and realized something about our condition. And I mean perhaps not just Freemasons, but humanity in general. One of the things, I tire being around people that are constantly trying to beat the drum and extol me to higher levels and inspire. After a while, it becomes tedious because it's the same. It's just background noise now. Their efforts are always sincere, always sincere, and earnest. But it's like, you know, you go onto a university campus and people are walking, are striding forward in earnest, leaning in, preoccupied with a thought. Or those, you pass somebody who is doing all of that cognitive rehearsal. They're talking out loud about the ideas, what they're trying to resolve or absorb. That's out of that, the inspiration might be when you sit back and take a breath, when you pause, when you move laterally, move sideways to look at yourself in situ. It's a remarkable capacity of the human mind, that ability, and what we see, of course, you know, it's not always joy, but we see, we have that capacity to learn from reflection. Today we have I think we've built a really put together a pretty good program for you. I think you'll like it. The natural progression influenced. It was just this kind of thinking that started me off on this little commentary. Can we influence the natural progression? Kind of an interesting play on these ideas. The music, I'll let you experience that for yourself. Be the judge yourself. I don't know if I ever do well, if this program ever does well with stern old boys that are sitting on the edge of their seat looking at the world with this the smell of umbrage in their nostrils. I mean, give me a reason. I heard this wonderful man talking about this the other day, and I know it's not airing laundry. We were just describing our environment and he noted how a person can go through, be listening to minutes, and we want them to just be processed so we can get on with our business. And someone will pick up a grain and make a speech about it. What else can you do but laugh at the silly old fool? You can't do anything else because nobody's listening. That's a sense of humor. That's a sick sense of humor, I realize. No. I'm sorry, God. I'll try and do better next time. Sit back and enjoy. We have a good program today. There's no question that any program offering is humbled by the poetry of John Donne, remarkable 17th century clergyman. His sermons, up until the time when we made anything ecclesiastical bad and naughty and, you know, just unsatisfying, some sermons were considered the most beautiful parts of literature. And now that's just not. That's just gone the way of the albatross in a way. I'm just going to leave you off here. I'm not going to leave you off at all. I've been fascinated by the fact that Donne's father was a well-known epigrammist, and for all of us who don't use that term regularly, I'll just give you an example. I can resist everything but temptation. Right? That's an epigram from Oscar Wilde. I can resist everything but temptation. No one is completely unhappy at the failure of his best friend. Groucho Marx. If you can't, this I cherish because I think she's a remarkable part of history, Catherine the Great. If you can't be a good example, you'll just have to be a horrible warning. So if if today, if Freemasonry is an adornment for ego or ambition, such an ornament, oh, such an ornament. I think I'll stop here and let you tell me what you think of the program. Discovery. What do you discover? It's discovery that inspires us more than anything else. And who knows when that is? If you're, and none of these things are constants. Let's be honest here. Let's be frank about this. Nobody walks around in a constant state of mind unless we're pixelated or obsessive. I don't think a life should be lived in obsession, personally. It's not going to happen. We are reactive. We are functioning it. And there's a generality that I think is reasonable, that at the end of the day, or the bottom line, which I like, my doctor used to say a lot, we all try to get by the best way we can. That first order, that first principle, that's not to me or a lodge or to creator. First is to you, to survive. Having talked to too many people on that knife edge of nihilism, death, I found it to be remarkably accurate. Whether people like it, I don't know whether they agree. It's a little subsequent. It's like trying to agree that we are spinning and that we spin around our sun. What's the agreement? It really doesn't matter. It happens. It's like physics, whether I agree with them or not. Right now, we are going through a lot of self-indulgence where the individual idea, the individual opinion ranks supreme over all else. There's been dangerous precedent to that. Hopefully we would have learned that there is more to life than the narrowness of an individual opinion. Don't rely on anything you hear me expounding on. Go and do your own research if you want. Plato, great ideas. You trace it down. You look at his work on opinion and truth. Fascinating. Out of all of these opinions, in my clamor to put forward and dominate the conversation with my opinion, I lose track of the fact that whether it's accurate or not is more important, at least for the likes of me, than whether I'm claiming truth or untruth. It's like trying to be right all the time. If you're living in a world where you're attempting to be right all the time, your world is always divided. I don't mean the smugness of the sportsman. They're saying there's only winning is everything. I don't buy that. But if you've ever been fly fishing with me, you'll know it's wonderful. But catching that trout, that's just cream in the coffee. Oh, there's more that we can experience. If you're living in that right world, you're living in the right and wrong world. Somebody else is wrong. The question is, how's that working for you? You mean that you're the person, your opinion prevails, and you are able to determine right from wrong for the rest. That'd be a very lonely existence in that ego. I can't tell you what that is anymore. I haven't been able to for a long, long time. But My struggle is like why I have an eraser on the end of my pencil. It's like I make mistakes. I'm not as perfect as people that are right all the time. And maybe I don't have the pride, the ego to drive that forward. I have to be right, you know, blah, blah, blah. We do the best we can. The accuracy of our thinking is so much more important. And maybe that's teetering on the edge of subjective and objective. I've often done that, I will admit. The people that I trust are those that have very accurate information, but have share that same sense that there is always doubt, that question that leads us to a more refined way of thinking, whether that's in science or art. What we hear just elicits frisson, that emotion, that uplifting experience. The music does that. And how do we continually discover that point where our senses are just elevated by sound? I don't want to know the mathematics of it. I want to know what the musician is saying, what was on Beethoven's mind when he did that? What was on Verdi's mind when he wrote that, or Puccini? And then I can compare. What did they know? What did the great composers know? The great artists know. And they don't keep it a secret, they share it. It's just, instead of describing it in words, they describe it in brushstroke and color, that sense of light, the sound, with the same maturity and nuanced structure that rounds it out into emotion, even selecting the key for your symphony, huh? You're going to do it in a major or minor, I'm just saying. Life is like that. You live in the minor key, you live in discord. Do you live as if you've risen above? Well, I don't know. Always seems to be the path doesn't get shorter for any one of us. Where else could we go where we would have these kind of conversations, explore a thought, explore the history of thinking and ideas, and be taken seriously? At least that's the opportunity of Freemasonry. I still remember that notion that This is a risk, and we hope you don't let us down. We hope you actually amount to something, but always a risk. So maybe, who am I to fault people for going to church for the social aspects? Certainly not the widow or widower, where they want companionship, and they're likely to find it, thank goodness, before I get all high and mighty and judgmental. You get by, you struggle with the loneliness. That's not being alone. Loneliness is something we don't like to talk about. Hmm? In an accurate world, well, loneliness is just wrong. It's your own fault. It's like poverty, eh? It's your own fault. You worked harder. Don't make me laugh. Oh, yep, I sit here in Canada, a product of the clearances. Thank you, by the way, to the Baird for doing that, you know, selecting sheep over my family. Yeah. We make do. But you give intelligent people, let's say you take an intelligent laborer and you give him an opportunity to walk through a library. He's going to teach himself to read. He's going to find that the words allow him to articulate idea. And he's going to be listening until he arrives at the point where his content, his confidence is sufficient to share his ideas. And then, oh my goodness, it's like that Roman general who was offered the dictatorship of Rome, but wanted nothing to do with it. Rome was in trouble. Was it Cicero? No. He was farming. He was content. But they were able to convince him. Then he came back, led the armies, defeated the enemy, and then, rather than the grand march of triumph, went back to his farm. Who was that? Anyway, you found Masonic effects. Just, here's a little something to soothe your mind. The Lester Young and Teddy Wilson Quartet. Just, I guess we'd say they nailed it. Good way to start a program, wouldn't you say? The natural progression influence. See what I did with this, what we can do with these ideas. The order itself is imperfect. I know, no big deal. It's, you know, open your eyes and look. It rests on merit that took root centuries ago. The landmarks, I would argue, are not phenomena out of time. They hold a constant relevancy for those who wonder if the past does in fact contain valuable hindsights. Truths and reason are hidden treasures filed in a library that doesn't distinguish and provides a single index. Doesn't. A good idea is prone to immediate exploitation by those vested interests whose business it is to persuade and convince us. Knowing what we know doesn't come with moral judgment attached. What we do with fact and opinion varies. Our education addresses literacy requirements at an individual level inside an envelope of cultural value. Our leverage has broken down rather quickly. Cynicism is hard to distinguish from reality sometimes. Even trusting perception is fraught. Ideologues would have you believe what they think is in your best interest and theirs. So it is difficult to keep up with expectations. Or even to know your own. Our ability to fulfill our sense of responsibility shapes our lives more than we think. If or how we reflect on relationships, commitment, changing roles and purpose, it all matters tremendously and it all unfolds naturally. Therein is the passive, powerful notion of objective, subjective awareness. We carry ourselves to meet expectations. Psychologists would call it drives. We are taught a form of honor and defined commitment. How does this adapt for men who experience separations and divorce, a series of jobs that require relocation, men of intelligence, educated by the classroom discussion and real life experience, resilience. If we look for resilience in Freemasonry, we find it. Nah, contemplation serves us well. Thank you. You know, sometimes I dial it in right here. The poet and the poem I'm going to introduce or reintroduce right now is probably the antithesis of, well, makes us stop and think about the value of our Lord of the Flies mentality, where opinion is all impressive. My opinion, individual. If we can think collectively, there is an importance. It's John Donne. This guy was born in the, not really sure the date, but 1572, a while ago. And he died in London, we know that, on the 31st of March, which is coming up in London. He was considered the leading English poet of the metaphysical school. Now, he did have a job. Wasn't just one of those Ponzi fellows. He was eventually the dean of St. Paul's Cathedral. Born a Catholic. So he's often considered by brighter minds than mine, the greatest love poet in the English language. And remember, this is coming from a body of work where sermons, the beauty of a sermon was considered literature. And some of his religious verse and treatises and for sermons are considered amongst the best of the 17th century. So if you've listened to the program, you heard me talk about Thomas More. Well, his mom, this is like my best friend's sister is married to, you know, that kind of story. His mother is a direct descendant of Sir Thomas More's sister. And he was the youngest daughter of John Heywood. Heywood was an epigrammatist and playwright. And his dad descended from a very ancient family in Wales and was a prosperous London merchant. But his life was short. He was 4 years old when his father died. And his mother, shortly after, his mom married Dr. John Simigis, who raised the Dunn children. So at 12 years old, either we're thinking these 12-year-olds were much more mature than the way we force a prolonged childhood today. 12 years old, he matriculated at the University of Oxford. He was for 3 years. And then we think most likely he continued his education at the University of Cambridge. But he took no degree from either university. Now make note, because as a Roman Catholic, he could not swear the required oath of allegiance to the Protestant Queen Elizabeth. Following school, he probably traveled to Spain and Italy, you know, that grand tour kind of thing. And then he read law, came back to London and read law. And then he turned to a comparative examination of Roman Catholic and Protestant theology. Can you imagine what a wonderful conversation? In 1596, he was enlisted as a gentleman with the Earl of Essex, successful privateering expedition against Cadiz. In the following year, he sailed with Sir Walter Raleigh in Essex in the Near Disastrous Island expedition, hunting for his Spanish treasure ships in the Azores. Interesting guy, eh? And then he became secretary of Sir Thomas Egerton, the Lord Keeper of the Seal. That's the guy. And then he fell with Anne More, the niece of Egerton's second wife and the daughter of George, and was Chancellor of the Garter. You know, these are well-connected people. So he married the woman. They got married secretly. And for this offense, Sir John had done briefly imprisoned and dismissed from his post. Teach you to let love prevail. So he lived in poverty for the next 10 years, a humiliating experience. He was at the charity of Anne's cousin, Surrey. Did he have the range of experience that you would think a poet should have? As he said, because I have transplanted her into a wretched fortune, I must labor to disguise that from her by all such honest devices as giving her my company in discourse. He wrote an amazing poem. Not the book. He wrote the poem, For Whom the Bell Tolls. Yeah, Hemingway used the title for a very famous book. No man is an island entire of itself. Each is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. If a clod be washed away by the sea, Europe is the less, as well as if a manor of thine own or of thine's friend were. Each man's death diminishes me. For I am involved in mankind. Therefore, set not to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee.
Jared will do that to you.
we're getting into the part of history that reminded me of the temporary nature of what we have around us. It goes back into taking a more thoughtful approach to the history of masonry. Instead of glibly saying, well, we're just an outcropping of the early guilds, we use the guild structure to explain our scaffolding that holds us together. But the guilds, and I don't know if history has an emotion with it, you know, that sense of loss. Gee, I miss the days of I'm a boy who answered the phone with an earpiece hung on the wall on a party line. And then the rotary phone was the first rotary phone, remarkable. And on a party line, and then a princess phone, you know, the push buttons, amazing. And now a voice-activated smartphone. I'm not going to trade that for the rotary. No. And I wouldn't go back to the days of listening to dial-in for the internet. Nope. Or Commodore 64. Nope. Sorry. Not going to happen. I might have a fleeting moment of nostalgia, but not much. Things come, things go. Here, Margaret Jacob, who is up scheduled to be the Sankey lecturer this year at Brock University, coming up in a couple of weeks. Worth a look. Check out Brock University. Worth a look. And I remember in very early days, it crossed my mind that she would be an excellent speaker, but she was already committed to Alberta, out in the West Coast. She's living in California, so it made sense. And that, why would she fly to the East Coast? Why would she endure that? You know, she was already doing, very, very robust speaking tour. But to get her by a Zoom, an internet link, wow, this is fabulous. Well worth a listen. Here in her earlier work, this is how she built her reputation on the detail and keen observations. And she says it like this. In early 18th century Britain, there was, in one sense, nothing countercultural about the new speculative lodges. They embraced the rhetoric of constitutional authority of the magistrates seated in Parliament. The emergence of these private societies suggests a new political mentality striving for expression. We have arrived at the moment when a political nation exists within one of the European national states. This entity, in possession of voting rights, governed in tandem and in self-confidence with an older aristocracy and a constitutionally limited monarchy. In the cities, the mercantile elite no longer needed guilds for their protection. In the countryside, the landed gentry expressed their political interests through parliamentary elections. In town and city, the power of the old guilds to regulate wages and labor had now been broken. But the collectivist definition of liberty and equality inherent to guild culture, complete with the ambiguities that Cotton-Nettle and anti-Republican opponents of Freemasonry were quick to seize upon, could be given new meaning. It could now pertain to the aspirations of the political nation. Voters and magistrates could now meet within the shell provided by the guild. in the new Masonic lodges, they could practice conviviality and civility while giving expression to a commonly held social vision of their own liberty and equality. As in all things new, elements from the past, from that once vital guild tradition, are also clearly present. There is the characteristic concern for the moral betterment of all brothers, as well as an emphasis on charity for members fallen on hard times. This charitable element will remain present in the lodges throughout the century and beyond. In the 1780s, the Grand Lodge of France had a committee of brothers devoted to adjudicating and distributing weekly and monthly charity to brothers who petitioned for it. We'll talk more about that later. As far as can be determined, the old guild ceremonies of initiation and the ritual associated with festivals and feast days were retained by the British lodges, but vastly elaborated upon. Yet the original purpose of the guild, which was to confer on its members the freedom and privileges of practicing their craft to protect wages and to confer status, and establish place within the larger community, is gradually replaced, and a new language is directly substituted for the old. Increasingly, the records speak of the liberty of the brothers, or lay emphasis on the older term, fraternity. Or, in seeking to describe the relationship between all brothers, speak of equality within the confines of this egalitarian vision. The working mason is still expected to hew stone and raise perpendiculars, but the new gentleman mason must practice secrecy, morality, and good fellowship. In this fascinating instance, the medieval guild is reshaped to give expression to the aspirations of the modern, constitutionally governed polity. Gentlemen Freemasons could retain the obligations and privileges granted by their social rank. They could also bond with lesser but literate and reasonably affluent men, and jointly practice secrecy and fellowship within the new British lodges. Gentlemen and even aristocrats express their political hegemony while laboring to create amongst themselves an egalitarian culture. This civility emerged within the confines of an ideology espousing merit and equality. I see our time, our short time together is coming to a conclusion again. I want to thank you for sitting in and joining. And welcome to the listeners from Singapore. It's a pleasure to have you join us. And to one and all, commit those acts of random Masonic kindness. Be particularly thoughtful about your own prospects and your own ambitions. Remember, you know, that although as we refine our skills as Freemasons, we may become increasingly contemplative, and man, that can reinforce that sense of solitude. I think it's also valid to consider that solitude is simply a respite. Thank you. I look forward to seeing you next week in Masonic Effects. And for now.